An extremely rare and important meeting here at the Vatican. Pope Leo sitting down for almost an hour with a survivor of sexual abuse. I'm Colin Flynn at the Vatican.
After more than a year, we meet abuse survivor David Ryan again to hear about his meeting this week with the Pope. Plus, an expert updates the church's current efforts to heal from the ongoing effects of the sexual abuse crisis.
I think with a lot of social media and everything like that, there could be cyberbullying.
We profile a Catholic program designed to help young people negotiate the pressures of being a teenager with an eye towards Christ.
Some kids went to the zoo. We went to the zoo, came back and wrote essays about the animals we saw at the zoo.
One of America's youngest bishops recounts his family's experience in coming to America, a unique take on the immigrant story. And Super Bowl Sunday, we bring back our annual tradition. The Archbishops of Boston and Seattle join us for sports talk and their wager for charity. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
You never forget about it. You never forget it. It's every day. It ruined my life. It ruined Mark's life. My brother's now gone. And other people have only started to come forward now. Their lives have been ruined.
The powerful witness of a clergy sex abuse victim who shared his story right here about 1.5 years ago. David Ryan wanted someone in the Catholic Church to listen. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Now this week, David Ryan was given his opportunity. Pope Leo XIV met with him to hear his painful story in an individual private meeting. Correspondent Colin Flynn reports.
David Ryan walks out of a side gate of the Vatican in Rome after a historic meeting. For the past hour, he had been sitting in a small room in the Apostolic Palace with Pope Leo, telling him his story of being sexually abused by a priest when he was an altar boy in Ireland.
His sincerity, his empathy, he felt my pain, but he hasn't experienced my pain, but he knows what pain I had gone through in my family. And just a lovely, lovely man. What an experience to have. Wow. I'm so glad I've done it today. I really am so glad I've done it. I didn't hold back. I told him about the abuse. And he said yes. And I asked him, why are these priests still doing it? His sympathy is empathy for survivors, myself and for my family and my close friends. He felt it and he was sorry, and it was genuine. I knew it was genuine. It was lovely, and he took many a deep breath before he answered a question, which was kind of funny watching him taking his deep breath. But he was good. It was really, really good. Very happy.
David Ryan, now 61, was abused as a schoolboy while attending Blackrock College and Willow Park in Dublin. He shared his story with EWTN in 2024 about how bad the abuse got when he was roughly between the ages of 11 and 17.
I came in, he locked the door behind me, he told me to get naked, told me to lie down on the bed. He got my hands and he tied them. He got on top of me and he raped me again. I was scared. He'd often put his hands around my throat when he was doing it, and he would say, "You do not say anything about what happened here today."
His brother Mark was also abused, but sadly has since passed away at the age of 62. David Ryan's story shocked Ireland when he featured in a documentary called Black Rock Boys on Irish radio station RTE.
My name is David Ryan, originally from Black Rock in County Dublin, now living in County Tipperary.
As a result, the Irish government commissioned a report which found widespread allegations of sexual abuse across hundreds of schools over several decades. This all because of David's bravery and others like him coming forward to tell their story.
It ruined my life. It ruined Mark's life. My brother's now gone.
David and other victims felt they weren't being heard by the religious orders or the church in Ireland. And that's when David decided to go all the way to the top and wrote a letter to Pope Leo, and incredibly, he received a response. And on Monday, February the 2nd, an invitation from the papal household for a private meeting lay on the desk of David's hotel room as he prepared to walk to the Vatican.
Well, this is the reason I'm coming. I want the Pope to hear my story.
With him, David had brought a picture of his late brother Mark. Leaving his hotel and walking to the Vatican, David was joined by Deirdre Kenny, the CEO of One in Four, an Irish charity that provides counselling and support to adults who have experienced sexual abuse. The significance of this meeting cannot be understated. While Pope Leo has met victims of abuse in a group setting before, the Vatican confirmed that David Ryan was the first victim to meet one-on-one privately with the Pope.
Just trying to take it all in. I mean, and Deirdre and I were walking up and kind of looking at each other and going, this is happening. The day has come.
And after the meeting, which lasted almost an hour, I sat down with David, where he told me about what it was like inside that room with the Pope.
I stood up, the Pope came out, and we both greeted each other. I shook his hand, he shook my hand, and he said, welcome, David, thank you for coming. And I said, well, thank you for letting me come. It's a privilege.
Did you ask him for an apology?
I did say I want an apology. And the first thing he said, David, all I can say is I'm so sorry for your pain and hurt, what your family went through, what Mark went through, and the other survivors. I can feel your pain, but I don't know your pain. And he looked me straight in the eyes and just, I'm so sorry for you. And that was all.
Wow.
But I could feel like an energy coming down when he said it to me, because I knew he meant it. It's like an outer experience for me. It's still kind of going down. I still can't believe I've been there. I thought this day would never come.
And when you were going in, David, were you going in with the mindset that I want to get answers from this Pope? I'm angry. I want to confront him. I want to just share my story. What was your mindset like going in?
Oh, Callum, I think you said everything, all the words I wanted. But I went in with the mind of, well, I'm not going to shout and scream because there's no point in having your... I just wanted him to hear my voice. I wanted him to hear my story, which he heard. He apologised in a way that I wasn't expecting. And his empathy towards me, it was just quiet and surreal. And I didn't hold back. I told him about being raped 3 times. Not a nice thing, but I said a lot of men are afraid to talk about it, and a lot of men don't cry. Well, I'm one of those now. I can try to talk about it. I have cried.
How did he react, David, when you told him exactly what happened to you, and you, as you say, you didn't hold back?
You could see him gasp when he said it, and just to see him, and his jaw dropped, and he just said, David, I'm so sorry.
When you told him, David, about your own story and what happened to you, but how this has been the story for so many in Ireland, sadly, tragically, did you get the sense that he was aware of this, or this was new to him, or the scale of it, or how did he react in that sense?
He was shocked to hear how many people have been abused, and the church hid it for so long. And I asked him, why? Why were they doing this? And he said, David, I don't have an answer yet for you, but I will have an answer when I can.
Most victims will never have the chance to meet the Pope and share their story directly with him. But David is hoping his meeting will help others speak out.
What are your initial feelings after having that meeting with the Pope? For you yourself and your story and what you went through, how do you feel?
I think it was very powerful. It had to be done. I wanted to do it. And I definitely got something out of it. He heard my story. I've done this for a reason. For other people, please God, they will come forward more and talk about clerical abuse, because a lot of men don't talk and keep it quiet. And as I said to the Pope this morning, it wasn't my fault. Now, that's taken a long time to admit, it wasn't my fault. And he shook his head at me. He says, yes, it wasn't your fault, David. And that really did hit me. We shook hands afterwards, And I know he understands. And it was the best thing I've ever done.
In Rome, Colm Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
To discuss the significance of David Ryan's meeting with Pope Leo and to bring us more context about where the Catholic Church is now in its efforts to address an issue that has caused so much pain to so many, we are joined by a leading authority on this decades-old scandal. Father Hans Zollner is director of the Institute of Anthropology at the Pontifical Gregorian University, an internationally renowned expert in protecting children and vulnerable adults from clerical sex abuse. Father Zollner was a founding member of the Vatican's Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors and served on that commission until his resignation nearly 3 years ago. He is a theologian, psychologist, and licensed psychotherapist. Father, thank you for joining us. First, what is your immediate impression of the significance of Pope Leo's meeting with abuse survivor David Ryan this week, the first Irish clerical sex abuse survivor to meet individually with Pope Leo?
Thank you for having me, and thank you for bringing this up again. This is a topic that needs attention, also in media. And I think the meeting of the survivor, the Irish survivor, shows that the Pope is consistent in his commitment to listening to survivors. This is not the first time that he met survivors during his pontificate. He had met with groups of survivors in October and November, and Mr. Ryan says after his meeting with the Pope on Monday goes along with what the survivors in the other two meetings, previous meetings, told us afterwards. Mm-hmm. The Pope is a very good listener. Mm-hmm. He's very empathetic. He's very clear in his message to the survivors, mm-hmm. that he prays for them, yeah. That he works for more consistency in childcare and child protection, and that this is one of his priorities, and that he knows that healing comes not only through individual reconciliation, but also through the response of the church and the church leadership.
And just to emphasize one of those points, Father, as you hit on in his comments to the press, David Ryan really seemed especially grateful for how our Holy Father took that time to listen to him and to hear him out and to hear his pain. How critical is that step when it comes to the healing process for abuse survivors and for the church's response to the clerical sex abuse crisis?
All the survivors I have met had one message, very important message to all of us. That is, listen to us. Independently from where they come from, whatever their other expectations are, they want first and foremost to be listened to and to believed in and to be empathetic with their pain, which very often goes back for decades. Mm. So this is the first example that the Pope gives to us, as Pope Francis had done when he met survivors from early on in his pontificate. Mm-hmm. Of course, survivors expect different things. Some want to receive psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. Some want to be received back in church communities where they feel alienated. Some demand redress and money. So you always have to look out for what this particular person expects and what are their demands and what the church can offer there. But all I have met really put first being listened to, mm-hmm. as the one thing that sticks out. And Pope Leo has given a wonderful example of how one listens with the heart, mm-hmm. and with one's whole existence.
And I understand you first met our Holy Father when he served as prior general of the Order of St. Augustine in Rome. What actions and signals have you seen from Pope Leo already in his pontificate that indicate how he's approaching the clerical sex abuse crisis?
I do think that as a prior general, when I met him for the first time almost 15 years ago, he learned very early on as an American-born and one who resides in Rome and knows about the questions that have really come to the church over the decades, that sex abuse and other types of abuse, the questions of safeguarding in general, have to be one of the priorities of the church's mission. Mm-hmm. because it is part and parcel of the gospel when Jesus tells us to be kind to each other, but also especially to protect the most vulnerable ones. Mm.
If you had the opportunity to give Pope Leo your expert advice on how the church can better safeguard against future abuse, what would you say?
It's important to let people know that we expect bishops, provincials, but everybody who has some authority and power in the church, that's not only the hierarchy or not only clergy, that we follow the procedure and the laws that are already in place. I don't think we need much more law or more provisions in this sense. Mm. What we need is consistency, and what we need is accountability. Mm. And I think that was in the late Pope Francis's pontificate, that was one of the aspects that we learned, that this is to be underlined. And I do hope that the Pope Leo will continue in this line.
Father, in my last minute with you right now, this topic is so heavy. As someone who has to encounter the dark and evil reality of clerical sex abuse in your everyday work, what do you think our viewers should know about the reality of abuse today and how we, as a church militant, can respond to this evil?
It's surely that we pray for victims, for those accused, and for the leaders of the church who sometimes have to take tough decisions. I mean, when I ask in the audience where I go everywhere in the world, and I ask, when did you pray for victims of abuse the last time, personally and liturgically, there is very often dead silence, which indicates that we pray for the poor, we pray for the handicapped, we pray for those in custody and so forth. But we rarely remember in prayer those who have been harmed so grievously through any type of abuse by a church member, be it clergy or not.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for joining us, Father Hans Zollner. We'll leave it there. Thank you. We're just getting started. There's much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. Important news, plus a nod to Super Bowl Sunday.
My mother realized very quickly, look, we don't have anybody in this country except each other and the church, so you boys are going to have to work hard and pray hard and study hard.
One of America's youngest Catholic bishops recounts his own family experience with immigration to America. Our interview with Bishop Earl Fernandez of Columbus, Ohio, in light of the Catholic Church's reaction to the ICE immigration crackdown. Controversy at the University of Notre Dame over the assignment of a pro-abortion professor to lead a major university initiative. We have reaction from campus. And are you ready for some football? The Archbishops of Seattle and Boston they will share their thoughts on the unifying nature of sports as they reveal the annual Bishops Super Bowl bet. The Trump administration is still dealing with the fallout over its intensified immigration enforcement action in Minneapolis, which Trump himself admitted this week in an interview with NBC News could have used, quote, a lighter touch. In a sign of possible de-escalation, the president ordered the withdrawal of nearly 700 federal agents from the city. Border czar Tom Homan says the more than 2,000 remaining agents will stay until there's more cooperation from city leadership and protesters stop interfering with federal agents. Trump's Operation Metro Surge has sparked intense backlash and protests nationwide. The chaos erupted 2 weeks ago when Alex Preddy was fatally shot by federal agents. That backlash sent the federal government into a partial shutdown over the weekend, and funding for the Department of Homeland Security still remains in limbo. Democratic lawmakers seek new restrictions on federal agents, many of which Republicans have already ruled out.
We're going to have accountability at DHS, or there will not be Democratic votes to fund a lawless agency. If Republicans refuse to make the changes the American people are demanding, they are forcing a Republican shutdown of DHS.
It's a non-serious demand. After all, we've already funded basically a lot of what ICE is operating on, and this is really kind of more of a symbolic move, really a political stunt.
One of the Democrats' proposals include requiring federal agents to wear body cameras. On Monday, DHS Secretary Kristi Noem announced that all ICE and Customs and Border Protection officers in Minneapolis will be issued a camera. Several of the Border Patrol officers present during Preddy's shooting were wearing body cameras, but the footage has not been released to the public. A forum on Capitol Hill this week allowed several victims to speak out about the injuries they have suffered at the hands of federal immigration agents. All of the Minneapolis residents invited to speak are American citizens without criminal records.
I yelled, "I'm disabled," at the hands grabbing at me, and an agent said, "Too late." I was never asked for ID, never told I was under arrest, never read my rights, and never charged with a crime. I was carried face down through the street by my cuffed arms and legs while yelling that I had a brain injury and was disabled. I now cannot lift my arms normally.
This 30-year-old Montessori school teacher was driving to her church to donate clothing when a border control agent shot her multiple times while she was sitting in her truck. She nearly bled to death from the 5 bullet wounds. And the brothers of shooting victim Renee Good talked about her on behalf of their family.
The completely surreal scenes taking place on the streets of Minneapolis are beyond explanation. This is not just a bad day or a rough week or isolated incidents. These encounters with federal agents are changing the community and changing many lives, including ours, forever.
Catholic Church leaders have been vocal about the administration's deportation initiative, urging restraint and respect. Many are urging Congress to take a stronger role.
The administration is applying the laws as they understand them, but it is Congress that makes the laws. And if the laws are unfair, unjust, or inadequate to the real needs of our country, then they should be changed, and that's the prerogative of Congress. So I would urge Congress to step up.
That's Archbishop Thomas Wenske in Miami, who has seen many immigration enforcement challenges in South Florida, including the use of the infamous alligator Alcatraz for detainees. Another American bishop has his own unique insight into the immigration issue, drawing from his own family experience. Reporter Mark Irons joins us in studio now with his story. Mark.
Catherine, Bishop Earl Fernandez of the Diocese of Columbus, Ohio, was born in Toledo in 1972. His parents moved to the U.S. just 2 years before from India when his father came to Toledo to serve as a doctor at a local hospital. Though born and raised in the U.S., through his family, Bishop Fernandez has a deep understanding of the immigrant experience. When he was appointed a bishop in 2022, he was the youngest bishop in the U.S. and the first of Indian American heritage.
And looking at your background, in a sense, you're sort of a son of Ohio, born, raised, college educated in this state. Same time, you're the son of immigrants.
I am. So I would say, you know, my parents were born in British India. They were married in 1963. They had two boys prior to their moving to the United States in 1970. The Vietnam War was on. There was a shortage of positions in the United States. My father took his medical licensure exam in India. He passed on the first try, was granted his green card, and came to Toledo, Ohio. Why Toledo, Ohio? Because the Sisters of Mercy had a hospital there, and they would employ him. And then he worked for a few months so they could bring my mom and brothers over immediately after that. My mother and brothers and my father had never seen snow. It was intensely cold. They knew no one. But the Catholic Church and the Catholic school opened their doors to our family. My mother realized very quickly, look, we don't have anybody in this country except each other and the church. So you boys are going to have to work hard and pray hard and study hard. And we did.
Being someone who grew up in this country, having the immigrant story too with your parents migrating here, what perspective do you bring to what is now a very heated debate over immigration in this country, how it's answered?
My parents and brothers came to the United States, you know, it were documented and everything. But to become an American citizen and to be able to own your own land was something for my father, because my parents were about 10 years old when India gained her independence from Britain. And my dad knew that there was a citizenship exam, and he wanted that so badly for his family. He studied for the exam. He memorized the whole Constitution. That's what freedom meant to him. When we were growing up then, it was a time of the Cold War, and Toledo, where we grew up, a lot of Hungarians and Slovaks and Poles, and we knew people who were behind, who had family behind the Iron Curtain. And so that also, they wanted freedom. And the more free we can help people to be, many people want to come to the United States because it's a land of hope and opportunity, a land of dreams. And they're fleeing their countries because of extreme poverty, violence, drugs, human trafficking. And they're looking, again, to America to be the melting pot and the beacon of true freedom. And so they're coming here. But our immigration system is broken as we know it.
Talking about this issue, I can see it gets you emotional.
Yeah, because when I look out, you know, our Hispanic population the last 2 years grew 20%. And when we have our Hispanic Youth Leadership Summit, I look out at all those young people who are now in our Catholic schools and trying to make a life here. And I see our family 50 years ago. And we made it. And it was because the church was there for us and supported us and welcomed us. And I want to give people the opportunity to have an education and to grow in faith that they have Christ present. Here in Ohio, we have universal vouchers so we can get people into the Catholic schools. And we've got immigrants from all over the African continent who are Catholic and have lots of kids. We've got lots of Central and South Americans coming here. And Columbus is the fastest growing city, one of the fastest growing cities in the United States. And so our Catholic population is growing rapidly, but we have to adapt to the situation. But also the immigration issue is important to me because not only to increase the amount of freedom, but I think the diversity in our diocese is good for people to realize that we're no longer an Anglo-Irish German church, that we're very diverse and that the Holy Spirit knows how to unify the gifts and to preserve unity and diversity and to really give people a sense of the Catholicity of the church.
The U.S. bishops put out a statement recently that said law and order should be upheld, yet they had concerns about the way deportations are taking place. Someone might say, if somebody is in this country illegally, shouldn't they be removed from this country?
Let's imagine you're 2 years old and your parents bring you to the country. You have no say in the matter. You grow up here, you go to school here, and all your friends are here. And then you get married and you have kids who are American citizens. What are you supposed to do as an example? Or people are naturalized citizens and they have their kids here. So no problem. They're perfectly legal, but they're viewed with suspicion because of the color of the skin or the language they speak principally. These are complicated issues. People have fled here and have sought refugee status. They're struggling. They to return them to their own country is a certain death sentence for them.
You were the first person of color to become bishop in the Diocese of Columbus, as well as the first Indian American bishop in the Roman Catholic Church in America. Are these distinctions significant? Have they impacted your ministry? What are you seeing?
Well, I'm seeing that amongst our huge immigrant communities, people can appreciate that I can appreciate their experience, and that I see them and that I hear them. Okay, with the Anglo-German-Irish population, I'm born and raised here, so I'm very familiar with the culture. It's not like I have an accent. It's not like I don't know American sports and politics and all this sort of thing. But I have to keep all these groups in balance and be the shepherd for them all. Mm. And that I think, is an important thing to do. It's not about the color of the skin. It's about God has entrusted this portion of his flock to my care. And can I care for all these people? Can I hand on the faith? He hasn't asked me to keep parishes open. He hasn't asked me to make lots of money. He's asked me to proclaim the gospel in season and out of season in this diocese.
Bishop Fernandez and I covered a wide range of topics. He has a background in biology and spent time in medical school, and he shared his thoughts on the unity between faith and science, as well as his response to some of the divisions we see playing out in the church today. He also spoke about outreach to young Catholics and those who may not feel welcomed in the church. That and more. Our longer conversation will be posted on our EWTN YouTube page, Catherine.
Amazing, touching testimony. Thank you, Mark. And news headlines are next in the Week in Review.
indirect talks between the U.S. and Iran top news headlines in the week in review. The meeting in Oman is the first since the U.S. struck Iran's nuclear sites last summer and comes as heightened tensions stoke fears of another conflict. Convoys from both countries were seen at a palace in Muscat on Friday. The U.S. had no immediate comment on the talks, but Iran's foreign minister described them only as a starting point for future negotiations over the Islamic Republic's nuclear program. President Trump has been threatening to strike Iran for more than a month over its brutal crackdown of protesters and has built up military force in the Middle East. Earlier this week, a U.S. Navy fighter jet shot down an Iranian drone that approached a U.S. aircraft carrier, nearly derailing Friday's talks. Ukraine and Russia held another round of peace talks this week. It's a significant breakthrough after more than 4 years of war. But key disagreements mean an end to the conflict is still far from reality. Officials from the U.S., Ukraine, and Russia met in Abu Dhabi behind closed doors. They have provided no updates on progress, but Russia and Ukraine announced a prisoner exchange shortly after the talks ended. But even with peace negotiations, the war drags on. This week, Russia launched a massive attack on Ukraine's power grid, its largest launch of missiles since 2024. Hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians have been left without heat and power. Despite these continued attacks, one of Ukraine's bishops says the faithful continue to lean on their faith.
It's already on the fourth year of the full-scale invasion. People understood already that the promises that we get from politicians, they're not going to find hope in those promises. Our hope comes from the Lord, which is what the scriptures say.
As wars rage around the world, Pope Leo thanked consecrated men and women for being a prayerful voice of peace. In a powerful homily on Monday, the Holy Father encouraged religious communities to be leaven of peace and to continue their work even as weapons roar and violence prevails.
I vostri fondatori, le vostre fondatrici.
Your founders and foundresses, docile to the action of the Holy Spirit, offer your wonderful models of how to fulfill this mandate faithfully and effectively. They became a prayerful presence in hostile or indifferent environments, a generous hand and a friendly shoulder amid degradation and abandonment, and witnesses of peace and reconciliation in situations marked by violence and hatred.
Pope Leo's homily commemorated the 30th World Day of Prayer for Consecrated Life, an annual observance tied with the Church's Feast of the Presentation of the Lord, also called Candlemas. Dozens of consecrated men and women began the Mass with a candlelit procession, a reminder they are called to reflect the light of Christ to those they serve. Students and faculty alike are speaking out against the University of Notre Dame for defending its decision to appoint an abortion advocate to a prominent position. The university recently announced Associate Professor Susan Osterman will serve as director of the Leo Institute for Asia and Asian Studies beginning this summer. Some faculty members have been very vocal, asking the university to reverse the appointment. At least two scholars have already cut ties with the institute. Osterman has frequently supported abortion in her published articles. In one column, she calls abortion freedom enhancing and decried what she called forced pregnancy and childbirth as violence. Notre Dame has defended its decision to appoint Osterman, saying in a statement to our sister news service, the National Catholic Register, quote, "Those who serve in leadership positions at Notre Dame do so with the clear understanding that their decision-making as leaders must be guided by and consistent with the university's Catholic mission." One Notre Dame student called Osterman's appointment a slap in the face to women at the university, writing in a letter to the editor for The Observer, quote, "Until it begins to defend the sanctity of all life, mother and baby alike, in all of its actions, Notre Dame can never hope to fulfill the singular duty it bears to its female students as Our Lady's University." And that student joins us now from South Bend, Indiana. Lucy Spence is a junior at the University of Notre Dame and the editor-in-chief of the Irish Rover, an independent, student-run publication dedicated to preserving Notre Dame's Catholic identity. Lucy, thanks so much for being with us. You say that the appointment of an abortion advocate at a university dedicated to Our Lady is especially astonishing. Can you expand on that point?
Yeah, well, first, thank you so much for having me on today to talk about this. When I first heard about the news, it was astonishing, obviously, first because Notre Dame is a Catholic university, and as such, it should adhere to, you know, Catholic doctrinal teachings. But I think more importantly, and this stands very true for me as a female student, and I think for all female Catholic students in Notre Dame, we're a university that's named after a mother of an unplanned pregnancy, right? We all exist today because Mary said yes to that call to life. And so for Notre Dame to appoint someone to a leadership position, someone who's virulently and hostily against the pro-life movement is really just a betrayal to its own name. Mm.
Lucy, Father Wilson Miss Campbell, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Notre Dame, told EWTN News what action he would like to see happen. Let's take a listen to what he said.
I think we face a situation here where the fellows of the university have to step in and encourage our president, Father Dowd, to direct the provost to rescind this appointment. Failure to do so will put at risk Notre Dame's whole reputation as a serious Catholic university committed to the sanctity of human life.
Lucy, what do you make of what Father had to say, and what role do you think the university students have to help sway the university's decision here?
You know, Father Miss Campbell couldn't have put it better. I think the reaction that we've seen beyond campus has been really encouraging, right? People of the Notre Dame community beyond campus has kind of been up in arms with this whole situation. But I think we do need to see more action on campus from students. So I'm encouraging friends, send emails to Provost McGreevy. He's the one who is largely responsible for this appointment. Send emails to our president. This really is a decision, right, that's in the university's hands and the administration's hands. And so hearing from the student body constantly that, you know, we're not happy about this is really important in addition, right, to all the backlash that they're facing on the national level.
Osterman has claimed that the pro-life cause is rooted in white supremacy. She's criticized pregnancy resource centers for supposedly pushing propaganda. You've hit on this already a little bit, Lucy, but can you speak more to what the student reaction has been to the appointment? You know, what you're hearing from your peers?
Yeah, from my peers who run in, right, like my Catholic circles of friends, people are very upset about this. It's really seen as a betrayal to the students here. Notre Dame is not, right, the administration is not leading by example. We're constantly, as students, we're getting the message, be a force for good, be a force for good in the world. And then we see actions like this. It's just totally hypocritical to everything the university tells us about what it means to be Catholic. So I think students are, like, less aware of the issue than the national scene seems to be. And so, again, that was part of my motivation in writing that letter to the editor. Students really need to be aware of this. I think for the most part, though, like Catholic students in particular here, they're very upset.
That's really interesting. And the University of Notre Dame was in the news this week for another reason as well, Lucy, when more than 2,000 students gathered for Mass outside of an ice chapel on campus. Crucifix, candle holders, altar, all sculpted out of ice and snow. And Lucy, I think many people were struck by the dichotomy of this news. You know, on one end, what appears to be a really prayerful student body here. And then on the other, you have this controversial appointment at a Catholic university. Can you reflect for a moment on the duality of those two things happening at once at Notre Dame?
Yeah, that event was just wonderful. I was there. I attended the Mass. It was one of the most beautiful and most pious Masses I had been to. It was a really striking example of the vibrant faith that's here at Notre Dame. And right, yeah, this is something people are commenting on. I like to say Notre Dame, you know, walks a tightrope between its identity as a Catholic institution and then its identity as a secular research institution. And those are two identities that are constantly at odds. Being Catholic and being an excellent academic university obviously aren't at odds, and those two are completely compatible. But the way that Notre Dame chooses to find that, to kind of find that unification of the two is not correct. And the Osterman example is clear example of that. So the student body is very, very faithful, and I think the university on the administrative level has a difficulty in living out the Catholic
universe. Lucy Spence, thank you so much for your voice and for joining us this week. Thank you.
Thank you.
a change at the top of one of America's biggest archdioceses.
I'm humbled to be installed as the 11th Archbishop of the Archdiocese of New York.
Archbishop Ronald Hicks takes over for the retiring Archbishop Cardinal Timothy Dolan. The massive installation was held Friday afternoon at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Manhattan. As leader of what's known as America's Parish, Hicks says one of his main focuses will be on evangelization and being a disciple who makes other disciples. We'll be right back.
For anybody who's losing hope in the future, and the hope in young people, all they need to do is interact with our young people. They are amazing.
I'm Marcel Regis, and I'm inside Newman Goretti High School in Philadelphia, where Culture Project missionaries are presenting about human dignity. We'll have more coming up.
Judgmental social media, peer pressure, bullying, all painful aspects in the lives of many teenagers today. A Catholic organization named the Culture Project is trying to make a difference there, helping teens to focus on their own human dignity and their Christianity. A key feature of the program is to utilize recent college graduates to help reach back to those who are just a few years younger than themselves. Roselle Regis has details in this Catholic Life report.
I think, like, when it comes to, like, younger people, they spend a lot of time inside, like, on social media or playing video games.
I would say social media.
I would say pornography is a big issue.
Social media and AI chatbots continue to capture the attention of teenagers. Even as teens expressed mixed feelings about social media's impact, these sites remain a key part of their lives. According to a new Pew Research study released April 2025, about 45% of teens say they spend too much time on social media, and roughly half of teens admit that social media sites have a mostly negative effect on people their age.
We are in this culture where people are telling us who we are and what we have to do in order for us to be loved or accepted.
The Culture Project, a Catholic youth ministry focused on human dignity and chastity, wants to make a difference and bring teenagers closer to Christ.
We are a missionary organization coming into different schools and parishes in a diocese, and we're trying to bring the second most important conversation to these young students. First being the gospel message, but second is God's plan for our sexuality and relationships. So we're really trying to bring that into the schools.
Before heading into Catholic schools and parishes, the missionaries, usually a group of college-age students, undergo months of training. They are taught by experts in the fields of mental health, reproductive health, theology of the body, pro-life apologetics, and more. After training, they live in community, committing to a daily holy hour and daily mass, which is part of their continuing formation. This group of missionaries is based in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. We joined them in one of their visits to a school nearby, Newman Goretti Catholic High School.
The missionaries come back to the school almost every other week. Today, their presentation is about human dignity.
Human dignity is the reality that it is fundamentally good that the human person exists.
Students tell us what they took away from the presentation.
God's created everyone with human dignity.
It reminded me, and I'm sure others, to respect one another and ourselves.
I think it did change my perspective, especially on things like abortion.
Along with giving presentations and telling personal stories, missionaries also walk with students throughout the year, joining them for lunch, attending sports events, and visiting them after school. After establishing a relationship with the students, they then address chastity, sexual integrity, and healthy social media use.
Honestly, I love just talking to the students, really getting to enter into a relationship with them, even if it's for only one time, even if it's 30 times, no matter how many times it is, we have the opportunity to plant seeds in their lives.
But my favorite part is whenever someone comes up to us personally, one-on-one, and has these like really deep questions that they have in their hearts and that we're able to have a really intimate conversation about.
Angeline Graves, the director of school ministry at Newman Goretti, says she is inspired by the interaction between Culture Project missionaries and students.
Missionaries interacting with our students and being able to come in and talk to them is such a privilege and such an honor to see that the faith is not dead and the faith is not boring, and it's not just this like set of rules that you have to conform to, but that is something that is really freeing and the same joy that the missionaries have.
The Culture Project, founded by Christina Barba Whalen in 2014, serves in several U.S. dioceses, including the Diocese of Toledo, Diocese of Cleveland, Archdiocese of Omaha, and Archdiocese of Kansas City, Kansas. CEO Greg Schleppenbach aims to expand and reach more young people in the near future, starting with recruiting more missionaries who have a passion for the work.
It sometimes brings you to tears, just the incredible impact that they are having in the lives of young people who are desperate for hope, desperate for meaning, thirsting for the truth. And our missionaries are there, hand in hand, side by side with them.
Russell Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
If you would like to find out more about the Culture Project, there is a lot more information at its website, thecultureproject.org. And next, what you've all been waiting for, EWTN News in Depth's annual Bishop Super Bowl bet.
Standing by to make their wager, the Archbishops of Boston and Seattle, home of the New England Patriots and the Seattle Seahawks. We'll be right back.
What we're trying to do is to try and invite people during this time, when they're here for sport, to think about the things that give purpose and meaning in life. At the heart of this is solidarity, celebration, identity, community, sense of belonging.
The Winter Olympics have officially begun in Milan, drawing hundreds of thousands of sports fans to the northern Italian city. The Basilica of Babila, located in the heart of Milan and close to the Olympic Village, has opened its doors to allow athletes, staff, and visitors a chance to stop and pray. In a special message ahead of the Games, Pope Leo expressed his hope that healthy competition will build bridges between people and promote welcoming, solidarity, and peace. The Holy Father is right. Sports do have a powerful way of bringing us together. This weekend, the Super Bowl, America's biggest sporting tradition, will be no exception, gathering friends, families, and maybe even some strangers together to root for their team. Preparations are underway in San Francisco for Super Bowl 60. This year, it's the New England Patriots taking on the Seattle Seahawks. Both underdog teams faced more than 50-1 odds of making it to the championship at the beginning of the season. More than 100 million viewers are expected to tune in for Sunday's big game. And joining us now are the archbishops of the rival Super Bowl teams who are carrying on the annual tradition here on EWTN News in Depth of engaging in a friendly wager to benefit Catholic nonprofits in the team's respective cities. Archbishop Richard Henning leads the Archdiocese of Boston, home of the New England Patriots, and Archbishop Paul Etienne leads the Archdiocese of Seattle, home of the Seattle Seahawks. Thank you both for joining us for this tradition we've come to have here on EWTN News in Depth every Super Bowl weekend. Before we dive into the wager you two have come up with, I know you both wanted to acknowledge that while this is a fun weekend for football fans, it does come amid a tense time in our nation and for many of the Catholic faithful. Archbishop Henning, is there anything you want to say on that?
I think this is an important moment of unity. This is a shared cultural moment, hopefully a moment for people to gather, be with friends and family, a joyful thing. But at the same time, we don't want to forget that there are other realities in our world and suffering. Be attentive to that as well. Mm-hmm. So I was grateful to Archbishop Etienne for really kind of surfacing that in our first conversation.
Yeah. And Archbishop Etienne, what do you want to say about this moment in our nation right now?
It's a situation that requires attentiveness and sensitivity. And I think while there's always great enthusiasm and excitement around the Super Bowl, this tradition of a friendly wager between the bishops of the teams Archbishop Henning and I just simply wanted to acknowledge that we do realize we got more important matters that we are being attentive to, but at the same time, we recognize the great role that sports and relaxation play mm-hmm. in the lives of mm-hmm. our people, too.
Well, and I understand it was, you know, really the tensions of our time that shaped what your Super Bowl wager would be. So, Archbishop Henning, do you mind giving us the big reveal? What is the Super Bowl wager you two have agreed upon?
So I think we're making a wager of $500 donation to our respective Catholic charities with a particular focus on the care and support for immigrants.
That is such a thoughtful response to the times and truly Catholic way to engage with the Super Bowl rivalry. Are you hopeful, as you both have mentioned, though, that this weekend's game might be an opportunity for people to cast aside differences and debate and come together? Is that an advantage that sports and recreation can bring, Archbishop Etienne?
I think that's always one of the advantages that sports can bring. Healthy competition is a part of so many aspects of human life, and it's good for people to have something to take their minds off of other matters in their world and in their lives, to just relax. And hopefully the outcome of the game will still allow everybody watching it and participating to still be relaxed and joyful at the performance of their teams.
Well, let's get into it. Let's look at this rivalry. Looking at this matchup, it's not the first time that the Seahawks and Patriots have faced off at the Super Bowl. And Archbishop Etienne, not to rub salt in the wound, but back in 2015, the Patriots defeated the Seahawks at the 49th Super Bowl in a game famous for a last-minute interception. So, Archbishop, do you suspect those Seahawks are coming back for their vengeance?
I just left a lunch with some of my priests, and I can assure you they feel that there is definitely better performance on the way this year.
Okay, some fighting words. Archbishop Henning, not to put you on the spot, but when I last interviewed you, I brought up the topic of sports then as well, and the fact that you are a New York transplant now in Boston. You told me at the time that you're a Mets fan, but if the Red Sox were to win the World Series, you'd convert. Okay, you've been in Boston a little over a year now. Are you a Patriots fan already, or do the Patriots need to win the Super Bowl for you to become a true fan? Okay, your answer is there.
Yeah, no, I'm absolutely a fan. It's a great team. You know, you asked about being united. This is a team that unites New England and Boston. It's a team that is committed to young people in our communities. They give a great example of hard work, resilience, discipline, and the team is very generous in going out into our communities among our young people, helping them with their sports programs. So it's a great team, a great management, a great coach who's a wonderful witness of Catholic faith, Coach Vrabel. So I'm very much a fan of them in every way.
I think the coach went to a Jesuit high school, if I recall that correctly. So,
well, we'll forgive him that, but.
Archbishop Etienne, I have to get your thoughts on this trend that people have noticed. In the 21st century, every time a new pope is elected, the Seahawks make it to the next Super Bowl. Pope Benedict XVI, elected in April 2005. Seahawks played in the Super Bowl February 2006. Pope Francis, elected March 2013. Seahawks played in the Super Bowl February 2014. Pope Leo XIV, just elected in May 2025. And here the Seahawks are again in this Super Bowl. So what do you make of that? And do you think it bodes well for your team?
I don't know what to make of that, quite honestly. I find that a very interesting statistic. I think that our players will certainly take a certain amount of good omen from that. And I know that our priests that I visited with prior to sitting down with you today think that that's a good omen on behalf of the outcome of this particular game.
Well, I guess we'll find out on Sunday if it's divine intervention or just a happy coincidence. Gentlemen, thank you both again for the thoughtfulness in this year's wager and for, again, just bringing some unity to the faithful this week. We appreciate it. Let's see who wins.
Thank you,
Catherine. God bless you. God bless everybody.
As they say, may the best team win. Prayers of goodwill for all the athletes, coaches, and the refs on the field that they may have good judgment. That's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.